Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
True West, September 2022 edition. Paths of Glory and Days of Darkness by Chris Enns and Howard Kanigan with Chris Courtlander. After the Battle of Little Bighorn, the seven officers' wives had an immortal bond. On July 29, 1876, Elizabeth Custer requested an audience with the widows and children of the enlisted men lost at the Battle of Little Bighorn. She struggled to maintain her composure while waiting for all to gather on the steps of her home. The sound of little ones laughing and talking drew her attention away from her own hurt. She greeted the children and the mothers as they slowly arrived with a smile. When everyone had assembled, she thanked them for their friendship and loyalty and wished them well in their lives beyond Fort Abraham Lincoln. Before saying goodbye, she presented each child with a picture of General Custer. The following morning, Elizabeth, Maggie Custer Calhoun, Nettie Bowen Smith, Annie Yates, and her three children, 3.5-year-old George, 22-month-old Bessie, and 7-month-old Milner, Annie's brother, Richard Roberts, a civilian herder and part-time newspaper correspondent, and David Reed, Elizabeth's brother-in-law and father of Henry Reed, traveled to Bismarck in the Dakota Territory via carriage and steamboat. All the ladies were dressed in black, and all but Elizabeth were seen crying as the steamship carried the sorrowful party down the river. In Bismarck, the widows were met by Colonel J.W. Raymond and were the guests overnight in his home. The next morning, they boarded a special railroad car to begin the long journey back to Monroe. The travels of the widowed ones, a name given the women by the editor of the Minneapolis, Minnesota Star Tribune, were covered extensively by newspapers across the country. Reporters, eager to get a glimpse of the forlorn women, especially Elizabeth, gathered at the train's first stop in St. Paul. They noted they were able to see the widows through the window of the vehicle. "It is a tragic sight," an article in the August 4, 1876 edition of the Findlay Jeffersonian read. "It is now thought that Mrs. Custer will not long survive her husband. Her condition is a critical one, and her death may be looked for at any time. The bullet that pierced the brave Custer was also the death wound for his loving wife." Before the train pulled out of the station in St. Paul the following day, another passenger boarded. Reverend Richard Wainwright had been asked by H.A. Town, the superintendent of the Northern Pacific Railroad, the railroad that provided the special car for the widows, to ride along with them and provide any comfort needed. Maggie Calhoun, in particular, was sick with grief, and nothing anyone did relieved her anguish for a single moment. Reverend Wainwright agreed to accompany the group until they reached their destination. When the train reached Fargo, where the passengers were to disembark for the evening, they found a large, respectful crowd waiting for them. All was quiet as the widows stepped off the train and walked by the solemn onlookers. Men removed their hats, and women and children lowered their heads. Stooped over and ashen-faced, Elizabeth led the way. She moved slowly, as though the weight of overwhelming sadness had become almost too much to carry. As the last of the stricken widows passed the sea of townspeople, several citizens could be heard crying. Even the men felt sorry for the unfortunate souls. They backhanded tears streaming down their faces or wiped their eyes with handkerchiefs. From Fargo, the mourners boarded the Chicago and Northwestern to continue their trip into Illinois. They arrived in Chicago on August 3rd. From the train station, the women were escorted by Colonel William Moore to a hotel known as the Palmer House. General Phil Sheridan had ordered the colonel to be there to welcome the widows to the city and to offer any assistance they might need. Newspaper accounts of the widow's visit reported that, with the exception of Annie Yates, the distressed ladies were very much prostrated. Had Annie not needed to watch over her three children, her head would have been down as well. Porter Palmer, owner of the Palmer House, and his wife Bertha offered their own private rooms to the widows and refused to charge them for their stay. The Palmers were so moved by the tragic event that brought about the loss of human life and the dignified manner in which the women comported themselves, they decided to start a fund to benefit the officers' wives. The Palmers contributed the first $250. 5 days after leaving Fort Abraham Lincoln, Elizabeth and the other widows reached Monroe. When Elizabeth stepped off the train, all efforts to control her feelings abandoned her, and she burst into tears. Perhaps it was the relief of finally making it home after experiencing unimaginable devastation. Maybe it was the memory of lost loves in such a familiar setting, or a combination of both. She had held herself strong for the others, but at that moment simply could not hold back the emotion. Reverend Erasmus J. Boyd, longtime resident of the Monroe Seminary and Elizabeth's teacher for many years, met the widows at the depot. When Elizabeth saw Reverend Boyd, she flung herself into his arms, weeping and then fainting. The reverend and other members of the church revived her, then led her to the clergyman's carriage. Maggie followed Elizabeth out of the train and was so overcome with emotion, she could not make it down the steps on her own. David Reed and Richard Roberts helped her to the reverend's carriage and seated her beside Elizabeth. Annie Yates, her children, and Emma Reed exited the train last. Nettie Smith stayed on board. The trip would not end for her until she reached her parents' home in Herkimer, New York. Former First Lieutenant Frank Camargery was present at the station when the widow's train stopped in Monroe. Camargery was a reporter who had been asked to cover the arrival of the bereaved for the Toledo Journal. In 1886, Camargery had been assigned to the 7th Cavalry under then Lieutenant Colonel George Custer at Fort Riley, Kansas. During his time there, he had met Elizabeth and grown fond of both Mr. and Mrs. Custer. The editor of the Toledo Journal had tasked Camargery with interviewing the widows. Given his prior association with Elizabeth and witnessing the low state of health she was in, Camargery refused to question her or any of the other afflicted women. "I contented myself with the barren formality of a card par condolence," he wrote in the article dated August 5, 1876. Mrs. Calhoun, the sister of General George A. and Colonel Tom Custer, and a widow of a third dead hero, Lieutenant Calhoun, is with Mrs. Custer, staying at General Custer's homestead, where the father and mother of the dead Sabre have long kept the home fire burning. Mrs. Yates, the widow of George A. Yates, who died in the massacre of June at the head of his company, is the daughter of Mr. W. Milner Roberts, engineer-in-chief of the Northern Pacific Railway, and a granddaughter of the late Chief Justice Gibson of Pennsylvania. She had decided to establish her residence here so that she may be near her loved companions in suffering, and has already rented a beautiful cottage on Monroe Street opposite the residence of David Reed. The widows spent the days after their arrival in Monroe visiting with family and close friends. They rejected unknown callers who felt compelled to stop by and pay their respects. Elizabeth warned Annie and Maggie against talking to strangers, pretending to be concerned for their welfare, as some might be newspaper reporters hoping to get information about Custer's command by capitalizing on their vulnerability. Some publications continued to insinuate that General Custer's ego and recklessness contributed to the outcome at Little Bighorn. The widows continued to be annoyed by the rumors. All found solace in reading the letters of condolence that continued to pour in from all parts of the country. Major General George B. McClellan, whom Custer served under during the Civil War, wrote to Elizabeth in early August to offer words of comfort. "As a man, I mourn in your noble husband's death the loss of a warm, unselfish, and devoted friend. As a soldier and a citizen, I lament the death of one of the most brilliant ornaments of the service in the nation, a most able and gallant soldier, a pure and noble gentleman. At my time of life, I can ill afford to lose such a soldier and such a citizen. It is some consolation to me, I cannot doubt it is to you, that he died as he had lived, a gallant gentleman, a true hero, fighting unflinchingly to the last desperate odds. My wife joins me in heartfelt sympathy. May God give you strength to bear under your burden of sorrow, teach you to look with calm resignation to the day when he permits you to rejoin him. Always your sincere friend, George B. McClellan." In a letter dated September 12, 1876, George G. Roberts, Annie Yates's brother, wrote to express his sorrow and share what life was like at Fort Abraham Lincoln since Elizabeth and the other widows and children were gone. "My dear Mrs. Custer, Mrs. Godfrey will write to Annie today, so I will mail a short letter to you, my kind friend. My thoughts are often with you and all the dear ones in Monroe. I look forward to my visit. I expect to fill Annie with so much pleasure, yet I dare not say for a reliable fact that I can get a leave. No news in the post. Did I mention the new club room at the end of the lane? It is almost finished. The weather for 10 days or more has been of the dark, rainy, unagreeable kind, yet I have not allowed it to tolerate any depressing feelings in me. How can I say thank you to you at such a distance when I feel a large thank you always in my heart to you on the interest you have shown in my sister? I hope Maggie is doing better so that Annie can have more of her company. Annie can always tell you and Maggie anything that is in my letter. Larry Milnor is sick. I hope he will be well again. With kindness to you and Miss Emma Reed, love to Maggie, hello to Annie and the children. You're all sorely missed. George Roberts." Neither Elizabeth, Maggie, nor Annie was in any state to respond to any letters. They were brokenhearted and lacked the will to do much more than make it through the next day. Maggie's grief had affected her physical health. She suffered with migraines and vertigo and spent most of her time in a quiet, dark room, seldom moving from her bed. Annie kept herself busy with her children and tending to her home. Nights were especially hard. She shared with Elizabeth that she often imagined hearing George's voice calling her. She had trouble sleeping, and when she did sleep, she dreamed she was back at Fort Abraham Lincoln, waiting for her husband to return. Elizabeth transformed the room she occupied at her in-laws' home into a shrine to Custer. His desk, with his books, papers, and journal, was set up exactly as it looked at their quarters at Fort Abraham Lincoln. She hung the stuffed heads of the elk and deer Custer had hunted over the desk with his favorite pictures beside them. His uniforms were placed in the wardrobe next to her dresses. Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading from True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier. Slinging Lead, Hot Type, and the Truth. Published September 2022 by Jana Bommersback. History tried to erase the courageous Arizona journalist, but her remarkable life and work as a publisher is a testament to her courage and her undefeatable spirit. This isn't a story about a woman history ignored or forgot nor diminished. That wouldn't be news. This is a story about a woman history tried to erase. Her enemies wanted to be sure she was buried without a gravestone. They almost got away with it. I stumbled on Laura Nyhel while visiting friends in Jerome, Arizona on March 28, 2014. I picked up a book in their library written in 1964 by Herbert Young titled Ghosts of Cleopatra Hill, The Men Who Built Jerome. Luckily, this wasn't an original copy, but one issued 37 years later, in 2001, when Aileen Alder added her chapter on Women of Cleopatra Hill. It was, of course, at the back of the book. That's where I found Laura Nyhel, described in 131 words. Bells and whistles started going off. As a journalist, why didn't I already know about this woman who had owned and edited a newspaper in Jerome in the early 1900s? Why wasn't she in the Centennial book just published on the history of female journalists in Arizona? Even I'm in that book. When I got back to Phoenix, my first stop was the Arizona Archives, one of the state's true treasures. They have everything you want to know about territorial days in that wonderful library, but not one word about Laura Nyhel. They've never heard of her. She wasn't in the Arizona Women's Hall of Fame, or in the Arizona Room at the Phoenix Public Library, or mentioned in any of the state's three university libraries. Nothing. I even found a publication of the Jerome Historical Society titled Her Story of Jerome. There's not a hint about Laura Nyhel. So 131 words is all she gets? I already knew that wasn't fair. Because those 131 words had grabbed a hold of me and yelled, "Hi there, honey, meet a bona fide Western heroine." They told me Laura Nyhel, a 52-year-old former teacher and married into a good family, mother of two sons, had done something brave. They told me that Laura Nyhel, a woman who couldn't vote or sit on a jury in Arizona Territory, whose sphere was supposed to be her home and children, had fearlessly stepped out of that role into a man's world and went to battle. They told me that Laura Nyhel was a woman unafraid to fight for truth and honesty, that she valiantly stood against bigotry and bullishness. A life-changing mood. The census tells us that Laura's family moved to Jerome by 1900, 37 years after Arizona was finally named a territory. 24 years after the first mine claims were filed on Cleopatra Hill in a mining camp that would become Jerome. 15 years after territorial governor Frederick Tridle took Jerome copper samples to the New Orleans World Exposition and caught the eye of a Montana tycoon named William Clark. And 12 years since Clark became the king of this hill with his United Verde mine that would become the richest copper mine in the world. By the way, Clark bought the mine on February 14, 1888, exactly 24 years to the day before Arizona became the 48th state. By the time the Nyhels arrived, Jerome had incorporated as the fifth largest city in Arizona Territory and had a population of 2,861 residents, 78% of them men. It would grow to be the territory's third largest city with a population of over 15,000, but that was a ways off. Even farther off was the day it became a ghost town, or as one historian put it, the town emptied like a fish stand after a case of salmonella. But that was decades after this heyday chapter of Jerome's life. Jerome already had an opera house, a half dozen hotels, a public library. It had telephones, but not electricity. It had three newspapers and four churches. The Nyhel family lived in the better part of town. Laura's husband, Isaac, was a tinsman and a plumber. The boys were in elementary school. Laura was the Jerome correspondent for the Prescott Journal Miner, which billed itself as the pioneer paper of Arizona. Laura was welcomed and praised when she bought the Jerome Copper Belt Weekly newspaper in 1909. The praise came from her competition, the long-standing editor of the Jerome News, William Adams. Mr. Adams told his readers that Laura was one of the best news rustlers in the country. He liked her so much, he even enlisted her to take over his paper when he was out of town. Her purchase put her in a very rare sorority. She became the third woman in the territory, at that very moment, to own a newspaper. The first was Josephine Brawley Hughes, who owned the Tucson Star with her husband Lewis. They became quite a force in Arizona. He became a territorial governor. She headed both the temperance and suffrage societies. The second was Angela Hutchinson Hammer, who on her own had newspapers in Wickenburg and Phoenix, and she founded the Casa Grande Dispatch. And now here came Laura as the third. Did any other territory have that bragging right? Jerome was then known as one of the territory's most melting pot communities and quite a notorious place. An Eastern paper called it the wickedest town in America. Somebody said with a wink, Jerome is not a city of churches, but hopes to be worse by and by. But Jerome didn't see itself like that. It once tried to contrast itself to sinful Tombstone by bragging that Jerome was a sinless model community inhabited by honest men and pure women. Nobody believed them. I'm betting Laura was a supporter of the important issues for women in 1909 as she took over the Copper Belt. Like everyone else in town, Laura and her family regularly ate at the most popular restaurant in town, Charlie Hong's English Kitchen. Of course she knew him. Everyone did. He was one of the most popular guys in Jerome, also one of the richest, and he paid more property taxes than most of the white business owners. He was a real celebrity. William Adams of the Jerome News had praised Hong more than once in print. That in itself, a pretty remarkable thing, considering that territorial newspapers were almost universally railing against Chinese people being in the territory at all. Mr. Hong escaped that wrath for a decade, and he may have been the only Chinese man in the territory who got any good press. Adams lavished on the praise when Mr. Hong was the first business to rebuild and reopen after the fire of 1899 that destroyed most of the Jerome business district. Mr. Adams breathlessly wrote, "There is no more popular man in Jerome than little Charlie Hong, and he numbers his friends among all walks of life. His credit is good for any amount with merchants, and he enjoys the enviable reputation of feeding more people than any other restaurant in town. He is American in all but birth. What more could be said?" Okay, patronizing, but still praise. In the summer of 1909, Mr. Hong went home to China to visit his family. He returned, making the mistake of coming through Nogales, which wasn't a registered port. The government threatened to deport him, but he was defended by the Jerome News. Editor Adams reminded his readers in July that Hong is classed with the best Chinese in Jerome. But he also added, "If he must have them with us, there can be no objection to Hong as one of them." In 2 months, that all changed. In mid-September, Jerome was scandalized when the Jerome News unleashed an exposé. Constable Charles King was charging that Chinese restaurants were raiding garbage boxes and serving filthy meat in their restaurants. King said he followed one Chinese crew right to Charlie Hong's restaurant. The charge came from a suspicious source. Charlie King's wife was trying to open her own restaurant, and Adams was using his newspaper to promote it as a white restaurant with a clean white kitchen. We're indebted to historian Catherine Reisdorfer of Yavapai College in Prescott, whose excellent examination of what happened next appears in the Journal of Arizona History in 2003. She pulled no punches. Charlie Hong, Racism, and the Power of the Press in Jerome, Arizona Territory, 1909. This is the only historical article I found that mentions Laura Nihel. She's not a major character in the story, and that it didn't inspire other historians to take a closer look at her still puzzles me. Mr. Hong immediately protested, saying the charge was a lie. Hong said that he used refuse meat to feed his pigs at his farm in the valley, but certainly not in his restaurant. When Adams wouldn't listen to his pleas, Mr. Hong went looking for help from the other newspaper in town, Laura's Copper Belt. She was printing her paper every Thursday from her offices in the basement of the New York store on Main Street. She charged 5 cents a copy, $2 for a yearly subscription. If I could be a fly on the wall of history, I'd want to be in that basement when Charlie Hong came in to tell Laura Nyhell his story. Did she grill him? Did she worry this would be an unpopular mess to get mucked up in? Did she hesitate? It surely struck her that a white woman, already infringing on a man's world just by owning her own newspaper, would really be pushing the boundaries if she stood up for a Chinese community that was being slandered by the most popular male-owned newspaper in town. There could be disastrous consequences. She certainly knew that. But from what happened next, I'm betting she didn't need a lot of convincing. She didn't hesitate, and she didn't flinch. She had the backbone to stand up against the drumbeat of racism, knowing she'd probably be standing alone. Laura printed Mr. Hong's letter with his strenuous denial and his countercharges on why he was being attacked. Number one, Constable King was trying to kill the competition for his wife's restaurant, and Adams was helping him. Plus, Hong wondered, how could his food be so healthy when the constable regularly stopped in to help himself from the kitchen, never paying? And speaking of being a freeloader, so was Mr. Adams from the Jerome News. Number two, Hong charged that Editor Adams was on the bandwagon against him because he had demanded Adams pay his outstanding bill. Laura not only let Charlie Hong speak directly to the people of Jerome, but she added her own voice. Her exact words haven't been preserved, but we can figure out what she said by the reactions she got. She supported Mr. Hong without evocation. She dismissed the charges as ridiculous and vile. She reminded Jerome that Editor Adams had lavished praise on Mr. Hong just months earlier. And she mocked his accusers in a way that cut to the quick. She always referred to Constable King as the gallant officer, clearly meaning he was anything but. And here's how we know she had a wicked sense of humor. She called Editor Adams Confucius 11. At some point, she must have written something like, "It's a privilege to stand with an honest, decent human being who's being slandered by freeloading bigots," or words in that neighborhood. We know all that because this was the reaction printed in the Jerome News. God, the pity of it, that white people should stoop so low as to crave the privilege of protecting them. In his September 18th edition, Editor Adams had his own say and printed his own open letter to Jerome, this one from Constable King. King declared, "If the men, women, and children who patronized them knew but half of the filth that is passed out to them, they would never eat a meal in a Chinese restaurant." Editor Adams wrote that King could have gone farther. He might have added that those whom they feed are blind to everything, or they would not partake of food that must be unfit for any human being to eat, and in doing so, keep the lifeblood in leeches, and in this way, assist in keeping a white restaurant from doing business in our city. But Adams wasn't content to rest his argument on the charge of filthy food. He didn't want to just destroy Charlie Hong's business. He wanted to destroy Charlie Hong. Now he called for him to be deported. He wrote, "Hong is what they call in New York City a Christianized Chinaman. The Christianizing of Hong has been his downfall." He claimed Mr. Hong was butting in on all church social affairs and dared participate in a basket social where the single girls of the parish offered a picnic basket, sharing the meal with the highest bidder. Adam said Hong humiliated a white woman by outbidding everyone for her basket. Charles particularly favored the lusting after white women attack. On October 2nd, Adams printed his most hysterical piece, "Found Maggots in Soup in Hong Restaurant." Every week there was a new horror story. Some are so absurd you want to laugh out loud. Like the one where he claims a couple found cockroaches in their salad and bedbugs in their pie. What? They ate the whole meal? Did they pick around the bugs? Adams now is attacking all Chinese residents in Jerome, not just Hong. And he didn't hesitate to use racial slurs. He wrote, "We believe in the doctrine of America and Americans and will always be found preaching it against a dirty, greasy chink." Then he demonized the entire race and any Americans who didn't see it his way. He wrote, "In their crazy frenzy, the chink protectors forget that they are Americans and are attempting to uphold, at the expense of American labor, institution, and citizenship, the lowest tribe on earth." Laura was giving tit for tat, rebutting the hysteria of the Jerome News and reminding Jerome about the Charlie Hong they all knew and respected. It was too much for Adams to take. On October 16th, he published a front page cartoon to humiliate Laura. He called her their missionary and declared, "A chink protector is a worse menace to American manhood and womanhood than a chink." He called her Old Mother Petticoats and an old hen. He complained, "Laura Nyhel, for the last few weeks, has indulged in expletives not taught her sex where good breeding is inculcated. It is not to our liking that we notice the mudslinging of a woman. It would be far preferable to wield a pen in defense of the gentler sex. Nothing could please us better than were the female sex never in need of vindication." And worse yet, Adams insinuated several times that there was a sexual component to Laura's defense of Mr. Hong. While Arizona records show us years of editions of the Jerome News and all these articles, preserving forever their racist headlines, suspiciously, not a single issue of the Copper Belt published by Laura has survived. There are copies of the paper before her editorship and after her editorship, but not during. So you can read territorial newspapers all day and believe that everyone, universally, hated the Chinese and never realized that in one town, at one time, and this may be the only example we have, the Chinese had a champion, thanks to a female journalist. No, we didn't have any of Laura's papers that survived. Until I went digging into a libel suit Constable King filed against Laura Nyhel. This was news throughout the territory, reported in several papers. He claimed she published a malicious defamation, which tends to bring himself and his family into disrepute and ridicule. It was filed on October 23, 1909. I figured it had to be filed at the Yavapai County Courthouse in Prescott. I never dreamed it would hold such a treasure. I got copies of the whole file. Laura had been arrested, but the judge released her on a $300 bond until a trial date set for the next week. All that paperwork was there, along with the complaint King had filed. And Exhibit H. To prove his point, King submitted the entire edition of the Copper Belt that included the libelous article. The court called it Exhibit H. It is the only copy of Laura's paper that has survived. We no longer must guess what Laura said or glean her words from the reactions. We can hear from her own pen how she faced off against Adams. She wrote, "The Copper Belt regrets that, in justice to itself, it is compelled to again refer to that dirty and villainous plot of the Jerome News. The climax in the fight of W.S. Adams, alias Confucius 11, and his gallant officer friend was reached this week when they tired in their unsuccessful efforts to draw the Copper Belt into their dirty, unjust fight against the Chinese restaurant keepers of Jerome." Why did this gallant officer go to Charlie Hong's and demand to know why he wrote his article and threatened to run him and all the other Chinamen out of town within 24 hours? Laura wondered how Charlie King could so attack the Chinese restaurants when his own family, including Mrs. King, had been averaging one meal a day there up to this time and passed directly by a white restaurant to get there. That was the libelous part, that the King family ate in Hong's restaurant. And she asked, why should this gallant officer visit these Chinese kitchens at night when he was on duty, helping himself to their pots and pans and standing while he ate, when things were so dirty? Her last big blast made it clear she felt he was a poor excuse for a constable. If Officer Charles King will attend to the business for which he is paid and devote less time to dogfights, he may save himself from a fate that awaits him as chambermaid at a livery stable. And Laura pleaded for her town. Why should the fair name of Jerome be besmeared with such scurrilous articles as have been appearing in the Jerome News? Editor Adams now demanded the Jerome City Council do something, and it did. It sent an inspector to Charlie Hong's English kitchen. It found absolutely nothing wrong. I couldn't find a headline in the Jerome News acknowledging that Mr. Hong had been exonerated by the city of Jerome, but I bet there was one in Laura's paper. Maybe a stacked headline in the style that was so popular in that day, reading something like, Charlie Hong cleared, no evidence of wrongdoing, city says. Jerome News discredited for racist attack. Mr. Hong thanks residents for standing with him during these trying days. Or something like that. Territorial newspapers started paying attention when it turned into a street fight. Thankfully, we have both sides of the story, courtesy of the Prescott Weekly Journal, which solicited columns from both editors for their story on the newspaper war in Jerome. Here's how Laura told the story. The Jerome News, edited by W.S. Adams, in its last issue contained remarks toward me that were slurring, unprincipled, undignified, and not becoming anyone in the newspaper profession. My son, who is a slender boy, weighing but 125 pounds, while Adams weighs about 195, resented the attack on me and engaged Adams physically on the street. How much he would have punished Adams had not an outsider interfered, I do not know, but I stand by him in everything he has done. She went on to declare, I am not to be bluffed nor bullied, and I propose to continue to write things as I see them, free and unhampered by any influences. Those are my sentiments, and I believe that they meet with the approval of the vast majority of Jerome people. When Adams told his side, he said he was attacked from behind as he returned from the post office on a Sunday morning. He described Mrs. Nihel's son as an athletic youth, but 21 years old, while I am 53 years of age. He said his glasses were ripped off, leaving a cut on his face. And for the life of him, he couldn't figure out the motive because, and let me quote, in all of my writings, I have endeavored to keep from becoming personal and have referred to the Jerome Copperbelt as simply a newspaper. I consider the attack unwarranted and unjustified. By Thanksgiving, everything had died down. And it was clear that Laura Nihel and Charlie Hong were the victors. The court dismissed the libel suit against Laura, and she got back her $300 bond. She continued editing her newspaper for three more years, until 1912, after Arizona finally became the 48th state. The family moved back to San Diego. Mr. Hong wasn't deported. He wasn't forced out of his restaurant. He didn't leave town. He became a naturalized citizen and registered to vote. His English kitchen kept its status as the most popular restaurant in Jerome until he moved on in 1913 at the request of none other than William Clark himself, who built a restaurant for Charlie Hong in the community he created for his mine workers called Clarkdale. Mr. Hong eventually went back to China for his final years. In contrast, Constable King had a horrible ending. He was shot and killed. Mr. Adams died in 1932 at age 74 and got a very nice obituary in the Verde Copper News. Prominent pioneer of Southwest dies in hospital here. Laura Nyhill died of bladder cancer on May 8, 1916. Her obituary in the San Diego Union called her a philanthropist who once ran a newspaper in Arizona. She was 59. She had been president of San Diego's Pioneer Society. In the summer of 2019, I visited her grave in Mount Hope Cemetery in San Diego. It was a very emotional moment. Having searched for over 5 years, I could finally pray at her grave and tell her how proud I am of her. I went to Arizona to acknowledge Laura Nyhill as a point of pride. I want American journalism to celebrate her courage. Why did history try to erase her? Because she dared buck the tide. She had the courage to stand up for an unpopular cause. I think her courage embarrassed the bigoted leaders she challenged, and her ridicule mortified them. And then she won. She bested those bigots. And the only way her enemies in Jerome could get even was to be sure history ignored her. They almost got away with it. True West, September 2022 edition. Rapid City, South Dakota, by Peter Corbett. The gateway to the Black Hills is the place to stay when exploring the region's parks, monuments, and historic sites. The state's second largest city was first called Hay Camp. Founded in 1876, the boomtown served prospectors, miners, and others who sought fortunes in the Black Hills. Now the place is known as Rapid City, and it's a base camp for travelers visiting Mount Rushmore, Crazy Horse Memorial, and Custer State Park. Rapid City, named for its location on Rapid Creek, is also convenient for day trips to Badlands and Wind Cave National Parks, Jewel Cave National Monument, Deadwood, and other Black Hills attractions. Kelsey Peterson, Visit Rapid City's digital marketing manager, said the most common feedback from tourists is they had no idea how much there is to do in the western part of the state. South Dakota kind of has this underrated opinion about it that it's a one-trick pony, where we have Mount Rushmore and that's it, she said. But there's so much history, so much culture, so many things to explore and do, I think it blows people away. It starts with Mount Rushmore National Memorial. Last year, 2.5 million Americans and others visited, taking photos of the four presidents, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln, their faces carved into the granite cliffs. The memorial includes an avenue of flags of the 50 states and the studio of sculptor Gutzon Borglum, who carved the iconic images from 1927 until his death in March of 1941. His son Lincoln finished the monumental sculpture 7 months later. Crazy Horse Memorial, with an 87-foot rock face sculpture of the Lakota Sioux War Chief, was started in 1948. Much work remains to complete the hand, forearm, and shoulder of the chief. The memorial has a popular Volksmarch in June and October that allows hikers to traverse the 6.2-mile route around the mountain and onto the figure's outstretched arm. At Custer State Park, visitors can watch a herd of 1,400 buffalo charging across the prairie during an annual late September roundup. The 2,000-pound mammals graze year-round and often congregate on park roads, blocking traffic in a so-called buffalo jam. Rapid City itself has its attractions as the second-largest city in the state, with about 75,000 residents. It's known as the City of Presidents for the proximity to Mount Rushmore and life-size bronze statues downtown of every president through Barack Obama. One is in the works for Donald Trump. Downtown Rapid City is also home to the Dahl Arts Center with contemporary visual and performing arts. Enjoy a craft beer nearby at Hay Camp Brewing Company or Firehouse Brewing Company in the city's former 1915 fire station. Western film fans can take a short drive south to see the South Dakota Movie Museum, including a film set of Dances with Wolves. It's part of a Western town experience that includes the Fort Hays Chuckwagon and Supper Music Show. A good place to start or end a Black Hills trip is the Journey Museum and Learning Center in Rapid City, with exhibits on the region's geology, paleontology, archaeology, Native American, and pioneer history. "We are very honest about the history of conflict," said Troy Kilpatrick, museum executive director. "We're all very honest about the Gold Rush, Custer's expedition, treaties, Wounded Knee, and the Battle of Little Bighorn. That's all here." There is an ongoing legal dispute over ownership of the Black Hills, 154 years after the Fort Laramie Treaty ceded the region to the Sioux, but that was ignored after the Black Hills Gold Rush in 1876. "I would never tell you our community is completely healed," Kilpatrick said. True West, September 2022 edition. Clash of the Mad Madams by Bob Bowes-Bell. Alice Abbott versus Etta Clark. The War Over Beautiful, Busty, Bessie Colvin. April 18, 1886. The beautiful Bessie Colvin is fed up. After a year of arguing over extracurricular activities and bad accounting, the star attraction at Alice Abbott's Bordello in El Paso, Texas, is quitting to seek better working conditions elsewhere. Bessie's also drunk, sashaying through the brothel parlor. The angry, soiled dove swears at the customers, telling them how foolish they are for shopping at Fat Alice's Belly Bazaar. At the front door, Bessie informs everyone within hearing that the prime cut will soon be found across the street. Storming out the front door, Bessie crosses Utah Street, heading for Etta Clark's Sporting House. Passing a trio of amused men, she mutters, "I'm not going to stay in that damned hooker shop any longer." After hearing Bessie's tale of woe, Etta Clark readily agrees to hire the raving beauty. With gainful employment assured, Bessie marches back across Utah Street to retrieve her belongings. As Bessie packs her trunk in her room, Madam Alice Abbott comes in and demands to know what's going on. Hearing Bessie's avowed defection, Alice flies into a rage and tries to slap her, but Bessie ducks the blow and flees the premises. Alice first sends two of her other girls to retrieve her errant prostitute, but when they return empty-handed, she crosses the street and climbs onto Etta's porch. Banging on the front door, Alice demands to be let in. Etta opens the door a crack. For protection, she is wielding a yard-long brass gas lighter that she has been using to adjust the gas jets in her house. "What do you want?" Etta asks. "I want to see Bessie," Alice barks. "Don't let her near me," pleads Bessie from behind Etta. "She'll hurt me if she gets a hold of me. She'll beat me to death." "She doesn't want to see you," Etta tells her rival. "Get out of my house." "It doesn't make a damn bit of difference whether she wants to see me or not," bellows Alice, as she flings her hefty body against the door, sending Etta staggering backwards. Through the open door, Alice starts for Bessie. Etta takes a swing at her rival with a gas lighter. Deflecting the blow, Alice says, "I owe you this anyhow," and punches Etta in the face, sending the madam sprawling into her bedroom. Alice grabs the hysterical Bessie by the wrist and begins dragging her out the door. Screaming and kicking, Bessie breaks free and runs back inside. Retrieving a bone-handled .44 caliber Ivor Johnson Bulldog revolver from her dresser drawer, Etta re-enters the parlor. "Miss Alice," says Etta, aiming the piece directly at her rival, "I want you to leave my house." "I'll leave your house," jeers Alice as she advances on her smaller foe. "I'll kill the damned bitch," cries Etta, pulling the trigger. Clutching her groin, Alice screams, "My God, I'm shot!" Alice staggers out of the house and down the porch steps before she collapses in the street. Etta steps out onto the porch and fires again, but she misses. Three of Alice's girls rush across the street to carry their employer back inside her house. The fight is over. Aftermath, odds and ends. The summoned Dr. A.L. Justice determined the bullet had penetrated to the right of Alice Abbott's pubic arch and passed through her body. No vital organs were hit. The next day's El Paso Herald mistakenly told readers that Alice had been shot in the public arch. Long after she recovered, Alice was often asked, "How's your public arch feel today?" The phrase later became a part of Western folklore. Etta Clark turned herself in to the police and was charged with attempted first-degree murder. On May 13th, a jury found Etta not guilty on grounds of self-defense. Incredibly, after the dust had settled and the wounds healed, Alice Abbott sweet-talked Bessie Colvin into returning to work at her brothel. True West, September 2022 edition. "I'm Your Huckleberry" by Sherry Monahan. The native wild berries of Montana are a popular treat. On June 3, 1805, William Clark wrote this in his journal as the Lewis and Clark expedition traveled through Montana. "This morning early, we passed over and formed a camp on the point formed by the junction of the two large rivers. The choke cherry grows here in abundance, both in the river bottoms and in the steep ravines, and along the river bluffs. Saw the yellow and red currants, not yet ripe. Also the gooseberry, which begins to ripen." As Montana pioneers arrived, they too found the berries Clark mentioned, but others as well, like the famous huckleberry and Saskatoon, a.k.a. serviceberry. The native peoples used various berries and their roots for medicinal teas, for treating coughs and other ailments. They also used service berries as a food staple for centuries to make pemmican. Clark's companion, Meriwether Lewis, wrote about the berries too. On August 16, 1805, he noted, "At 7 a.m., Captain C. Clark set out for breakfast. Willow, serviceberry, and currant bushes were the growth of the river bottoms. They gathered considerable quantities of serviceberries and caught some trout." Lewis also noted that wild huckleberries, which are tangy and tart, are small roundish berries that look like blueberries, grew in abundance, and the elk loved to eat them. As Montana was settled in the 1800s, pioneers found many uses for the berries. At the 1890s Fergus County Fairs, a variety of items were offered for sale. Jams included gooseberry, currant, serviceberry, and buffalo cherry, and wines made of currant, chokeberry, gooseberry, and raspberry were offered. Huckleberries were wildly popular and often made the newspaper. The Daily Intermountain in Butte noted in August 1899 that the huckleberry season was in full swing and reported, "Huckleberries having taken on the purple hue, many parties are preparing for a raid on the different patches in the mountain ranges hereabouts. The crop is said to be good this season, as there is nothing finer than a huckleberry pie. They are much sought after." In November 1909, Lutie's tempted its customers in the Anaconda Standard with a large ad that asked, "Why not make huckleberry pie for Sunday? 2 pounds will make 3 fat, healthy pies or 4 nice-sized ones. Huckleberries are extra fresh today. Special, 2 pounds, 25 cents. Lutie's had a similar ad for gooseberries, too. In October 1910, the Butte Miner ran an ad for the Montana Cash Grocery Company, which advertised, "Have you had a huckleberry pie this season? If not, you have missed a treat. They are delicious. The season is almost over. Pound, 15 cents. The Butte Daily Post ran an ad that had a slightly different take on the dark fruit. On page 8 of the November 5, 1910 edition, readers viewed an ad from the Fells Naphtha Soap Company that featured Auntie Dredge, who was their mascot at the time. The ad read, "Cross Mother, those children are worrying the life out of me to bake them a huckleberry pie, but I daren't do it. It nearly kills me trying to rub the stains out of their clothes as well as the table linen." Auntie Drudge replied, "That's because you don't wash the Fell's Naphtha way. Let the children have all the pie that's good for them. Fell's Naphtha and cold water will remove stains in a jiffy." Native fruit pies often appeared on menus all over Montana. The ladies of the Congregational Church in Billings held a fundraiser in 1897 at which they served a variety of items, including quince and gooseberry pie. The Bon Ton Restaurant in Helena, the Grand in Phillipsburg, the Bristol Cafe in Great Falls, and the Hotel Missoula all served gooseberry pie. And now we have a recipe. Gooseberry pie. 4 cups fresh gooseberries, 2/3 cup sugar, 1/4 cup flour, 1/8 teaspoon salt, 1 tablespoon cold butter cut into pieces, 2 pie crusts unbaked. Snip the ends off the gooseberries. In a large bowl, combine the berries, sugar, flour, and salt. Mix well. Line a 9-inch pie pan with 1 crust and fill with the berry mixture. Dot the top with the butter and cover with 2nd pie crust. Seal. Make 4 or 5 slits in the top crust to allow the steam to escape. Bake at 375 degrees for 45 minutes. If crust starts to brown, cover it with aluminum foil. Cool completely before cutting. Recipe adapted from Helena, Montana's Daily Independent, July 2nd, 1895.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.